difference, isn't it?
Seriously?
Council meeting for Tuesday, July the 23rd, the 2019, 9 a.m. is hereby called to order. I'd like to welcome everyone to council today. If those of you who have electronics would please turn them to the silent mode, that would be appreciated. We operate a very respectful council meeting. I have a notification from Councilor Gil Johnson that he's in the USA today doing electrical work. And all other councilors are here this morning. I have no changes to the agenda this morning. Are there any changes or additions to the agenda this morning? Hearing none, a motion to approve the agenda as circulated would be in order. Moved by Deputy Mayor Kelly, seconded by Councilor Frelick. Any discussion? You ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of the motion? It's unanimous. Thank you. Under presentations, we have 3.1 presentation, Mercy Tolbiatic Research Institute. And I would ask Jane Barker if she would like to come to the presentation table.
Can anybody see that?
It's coming up.
Okay.
It's slow.
First of all, I'd like to thank you, Mayor Dagley and Council, for having me present here today. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Jane Barker. I'm one of the fairly new co-directors for MTRI, the Mercy Tolbiatic Research Institute, that from now on I'm going to call MTRI because it's a mouthful. Our executive director, Amanda Labors, who many of you know, she was at MTRI from its instigation, and she'd been there for about 15 years, has recently moved on to Parks Canada, and the position has been filled by Jeffy McNeil and myself, who've worked for MTRI. We're co-directors, and we're going to be taking her place. So a little bit of background. I know that Amanda came on a regular basis and presented to council, but council has changed, and it's really just to give you an update. But I'm going to give you a little bit of background as well, because we've had some changes to our strategic plan, and then I'm going to give you a little update about some of the projects that we're currently working on at the moment, just so that you all know, because we're tucked up away in North Queens, and sometimes people don't realize we're there. So our mission, we've been in existence for around about 15 years now. Our mission is to promote, conserve, and sustain biodiversity in Guestbowick and beyond. Guestbowick is the Mi'kmaq word for southwest Nova Scotia. Our vision, we would like to see prosperous communities where forests and aquatic systems are healthy, connected, and where species are not at risk. I should backtrack a little bit and say that we're a cooperative, but we're also a not-for-profit and a charity focused on environmental research, conservation, and outreach. We're a membership-based organization, and we currently have over 1,000 members, and we partnered over the years with about 50 different organizations, and some of those are up here. So our partners are very diverse. I've put the provincial Nova Scotia logo a little bit larger than the rest because they're largely paying my salary to be here today. But we have partnerships with academic institutions like University of St. Anne, Dalhousie University, St. Mary's University, but we've also partnered with other not-for-profits and NGOs such as the Southwest Nova Biosphere Reserve, Adopt a Stream, there's many more on the second page. We're heavily funded by the province and the federal government, but there are also other organizations, like we've partnered with Mersey River Chalet's local businesses as well. There are several more here, and I'll mention a little bit more about some of our strategic partnerships later. Okay. So a little bit about the structure of the organization. As I said, we're a membership-based organization, and our board of directors is elected from that membership. So our board of directors, our staff are directly responsible to the board of directors, or at least myself and Jeffy are. And we have a staff that work for Jeffy and I as well, and I'll mention a little bit more about the numbers of those in a minute. But also, there's a lot of work for board of directors, and so we have a series of committees that work with the staff and with the board of directors. So we have a finance committee that oversees our finances, planning, facilities. We have some facilities that I'll mention in a minute as well. And then we have an education and outreach committee and our research, monitoring, and management committee as well. So those are our committees made up, not just of board members, not just of staff members, but of the wider community as well. And they're pretty busy most of the time. And then for specific projects working from those committees, we from time to time have to have working groups that are working on specifics, as well as our partners. So our business history, we started back in 2004, and it was largely a coming together of Parks Canada, the Biosphere Reserve Association, Acadia University, to try and, at the time it was seen that Parks Canada had lots of research, but they could only work in within their own boundaries, and there was a need to work outside of those boundaries that Parks Canada couldn't really fulfill, doing a lot of research work initially. But as you can see, we've grown considerably. There's quite a spike around about 2010 and 11, and that was largely related to some funding we got from ACOA and through our own fundraising to have an expansion to our building that also increased our assets. And I'll mention those a little bit more, but our gross income, the general trend has been on the rise. Our business history is reflected in our number of employees. We started with one employee back in 2004, and that has steadily grown. Again, there's a few spikes, and I'll mention a little bit about our funding sources, in that all of our funding is project-based, so we don't have any core funding. We're not salaried employees. We're basically applying for funding constantly. And if there's a year where we are very successful and we get lots of project contracts, then it means we can hire a few more people. But in terms of our core staff, there are probably generally 8 or 9 people there year-round. And right now, I did a headcount this morning because it changes over the summer. Obviously, we have lots of summer students. We have about 15 people working and one French student from France working with us at the moment. And in terms of kind of keeping some of those people, it's one of the most rewarding things about working at MTRI is the number of people it brings into North Queens. Over the years, some like me stay and work there. But in the photo here, this is a few years old now, but Maya over on the left-hand side she took a sabbatical. She's a university professor from Switzerland. She worked with us for 6 months. She now has a house on Tucker Lake. Gail, the tall person on the right-hand side, was another student from France. We partner with Agro Paris Tech in Paris in France. And we've had 2 students from there this year as well. Brad came from Ontario. Who else have we got? Diane LaRue was from the States. And there was somebody else. Maybe it was me. Maybe I was the other come from away who stayed there. But we also employ lots of local people. So Jeffy is from Annapolis Royal. Alan is from Mategan. Lindsay there is from the Valley. And then there are 2 people, brother and sister actually, who live right next door on Albany New Road. So it's a real combination of bringing people in. But many of them marry and stay, like Brad married a local girl and he's here now. So that's great. We often think we should have a dating service to go along with this, try and keep the good people. And our business history, again, I just want to mention that the way that we're funded tends to be project-based. So, and I'll mention some of the projects in a little while so that you can see that. But the point of this graph is to show that most of the project funding that we use is to pay for salaries and wages. So we really want to create that employment in North Queens. Some of the funding, the green bars there, are project expenses for things like mileage and any expenditures that we have to buy for the project. But very little of it is actually kind of primed off for administrative costs on the project, and a small amount for maintaining our facility as well. So when we did our strategic plan, every five years we renew our strategic plan, and in order to get the best input from our members, we usually do a full survey. And this is just a little graphic that shows what our membership think of as our strengths and weaknesses. And so the big bubble on the left, the larger the word is, the more people mention the word. So from our strengths on the left-hand side, things like education, outreach, collaborative. Again, we have lots of partners where we try and be as collaborative as possible. Research, dedication, diversity, commitment, connected, partnerships. Those were words that came up when they were talking about our strengths. When it came to our weaknesses, funding was the biggest one. You know, actually having continuous funding was a big problem for us. Fundraising, some people thought of us as isolated. Depends on where you come from before you move to Caledonia, I guess. Understaffed and engagement were some of the potential weaknesses. So just thought that's kind of an interesting thing for those of you that don't know much about us to know what our membership thinks about us. So a little bit more now about our current projects. So for many years, well, from the outset, we've had a really active program for staff and volunteers as well. And much of our work depends on that volunteer input. So we're constantly having both long-term and short-term volunteers, and also for certain of our projects, like our Blandings Turtle Nest Protection Program, we have regular community volunteers that we couldn't do our work without. We also partner with the Friends of Keji on our volunteer programs, particularly for the Blandings Turtle and the Eastern Ribbon Snake. And generally speaking, there's over 10,000 volunteer hours per year between those two organizations. So this is a picture of a big banquet that we have every Christmas. So moving on to before I get stuck into projects, I'll just talk about our facilities, our main building. Some of you are familiar with this. It's the old water building on the way to the park. It doesn't look like this anymore because we raised money and put a big expansion on it in 2011, I think it was. And part of the expansion was to use green technologies. Again, one thing that I think was one of the words in that bubble, the strength bubble, was innovative. And one thing that we've always strived to be is an innovative organization that thinks outside the box, and kind of has, because we're an NGO, it allows us to try things and do things a little bit differently. So during that expansion project, we decided to incorporate as many green technologies as possible. And we've got a generous donation from Akua that allowed us to do this. And some of them included, we have solar panels on the roof. That's one of our distinguishing features. If we're trying to tell people how to find us, it's look for the place with the big solar panels and the wind turbine in the garden. So we have both photovoltaic and solar hot water solar panels. We also installed this big swimming pool at the back here. It isn't a swimming pool, it was where we laid our geothermal pipes for our geothermal heating system, which actually is brilliant. It keeps us warm in the winter, and it really does keep us cool in the summer, if any of you've been. And the slide on the right here was, we had an energy audit done, and it's an old log cabin, and this is the ingress of the cold air. So we had to, in order to make it more efficient, we resealed the old log cabin. And also installed a wind turbine. So those are some of the green technologies that we've used. And in terms of bringing our energy use down, it's really worked, because here we were, a small organization in 2005, and now as an organization that's bigger, as a facility that's bigger and is employing many more people, our energy consumption is lower. So it's really, we try and walk the talk. You know, we're not just talking about it. Another interesting project that I'm not going to talk about for too long, because I think most of you know about it, is that we partnered with the North Queens Business Hub as a pilot for the TV white space. Previous to that, we had an East Link connection, and we used to sit at work and watch that little blue circle go round and round and pull our hair out. And this has kind of changed our lives, so it's been really interesting to know what innovative technologies can do. So moving on to our research and monitoring, because I'm keeping an eye on the time. These are our main areas of research. So we have aquatic health, species at risk, and forest and landscape connectivity. And I'm gonna just focus in on some of the newer things that we've been working on for the past year. One of our most exciting projects this year is the BAT project. So we've had funding from several different sources, and we have two master's students staying at MTRI right now working on BATs. One of our master's students, Laurie Finney, is working on repeating a survey that was done pre-white nose syndrome. I'm sure you're all aware of the white nose syndrome that has killed off most of our bats. She's revisiting all the sites that were visited before white nose syndrome hit. So there's 90 sites across southwest Nova Scotia. And the good news is that she's actually finding some bats. Some of them are still there. So that's really interesting. And the methods that she's using, she's setting up acoustic monitors. She's doing some bat counts, but she's also setting up monitors. This one is actually outside, I'm excited to say, was outside our barn in Caledonia. And I'd seen some guano, I mentioned it to her, guano's bat poo. And she set up an acoustic monitor and got all kinds of recordings. So we did a bat count one night and got a few bats as well. So they are recovering. But in terms of the spread of white nose, the blue area here is where it's been in Canada the longest, in Canada and the States. The red is where it's been found most recently. So it is really kind of spreading, and it's very unfortunate. The second of the master's students is working on a survey of tricolored northern myotis in Kedgi. And he's focusing his efforts in Kedgi and looking for some of our rarer bats. He's not having as much luck this summer, but we are finding lots of bats, not lots of bats, we're finding some bats, particularly the little brown bat, which took a real nosedive. So that's really encouraging. Another hugely popular project that we have is the Butterfly Club. Our Monarch Butterfly Project has, our Butterfly Club now has over 1,500 members. And Nicole Hubley is the lead on that project. She's an amazing educator, and she's spoken to, this year she did the same, I think it was 1,600 kids last year. This year already she spoke to over 2,500 children in schools and summer camps and that kind of thing, and done butterfly activities with them. So she's really bringing in the youth, and we're also growing and distributing the swamp milkweed plant, which is the plant that the monarch needs. Another project that we've been involved with that's not such a good news story is the hemlock woolly adelgid, which is basically an invasive bug from Asia that's killing off our hemlocks. And Colin Gray, who lives right here in Liverpool, he's been working with private landowners to help them identify it on the land, or to help them to be able to look for it and survey it. Sorry, I've lost a bullet there off the end. We've been partnering with Parks Canada, the Protected Areas Branch, Hunters and Anglers Associations, and recreational groups to try and increase the citizen science component of that and help people help us find it. And we actually had a phone call yesterday with a guy from the Canadian Forestry Service talking about potential research in Queen's County on trialing different silviculture or harvesting techniques to see how that might impact the spread of the disease. So that's another area of research. And then last but not least, our kind of flagship species, the Blanding's turtle and the eastern ribbon snake. Again, very, very rare, very confined to southwestern Nova Scotia. We're pretty special in southwestern Nova Scotia. And it's actually, we've been identified as a priority place by the federal government, which could really help attract funding to some of these projects. But another kind of good news story is in 2015, we found another geographically separate population of Blanding's turtles. And that's been really, we have another master's student, Carter Felton, who's from North Queens, who's working on that project right now. And there's so much more and so little time. Things like we work on lichens, eastern mountain avens, which is a rare plant on Briar Island. Chimney swifts, we do I think they found some chimney swifts down here in Liverpool when they did a swift walk. And old forests, as and when we can get funding for those projects, they're not there all the time. Forest stewardship has been my baby, and still is to a large degree, working with youth, outreach events at forest events, conferences, Woodlot Owner of the Year events, and so on. And we've, over the last few years, we've put on probably more than 50 workshops and training courses for private woodlot owners. Some of the bigger projects that we've been, I would say, instrumental in getting off the ground are the Medway Community Forest Co-op, and I know Mary Jane Roger has presented to council before, the Western Woodlot Services Co-op, which I don't think Patricia Amaro has presented to you yet, but we should try and let you know what's happening there. That's an organization that a not-for-profit that is providing services to private landowners across the seven counties of Western Nova Scotia. We've just hired two more forest technicians and a summer student, so that's really ramping up as well. And we've been involved in issuing an RFP to look at the potential for converting existing buildings that are using oil over to wood heat, and that was done by the Climate Forest Company, and I'm actually going to go to a presentation to the board for that on Friday, that's been very exciting as well. And I think they were looking at sites around Liverpool. I think one of the sites that they identified that had potential was the Amira Centre. So, and the other thing that I've listed there that MTRI was heavily involved in is the lay review, or the forestry practices review that took place last year. Professor Leahy asked MTRI to be involved in reviewing the state of the forest, the provincial state of the forest report. And also, this slide here was a workshop that we facilitated in Shuby Park to try and bring the various people who'd given Dr. Leahy feedback to try and bring them together and have a sort of debating day. So that was quite an important day from that perspective as well. Almost there. Outreach and education, we've had an ongoing program from the get-go. We don't just do science, we try and make that science accessible to the public in a way that is palatable to the public. And we do that through producing guides, having outreach events as often as we can. Here's a nursery school visit. We have a summer seminar series, so every Thursday at 4 o'clock in July and August. We have a guest speaker. We have one on Thursday. Everybody's welcome. It's free. There's popcorn. There's lemonade. Please come. And we have some fantastic speakers that come from all over the province. We also have a winter talk series. We put on workshops and training courses. There's been a series of 5 women in forestry workshops, which have been really popular, and to try and, I guess, address the gender balance in forestry. And we also have an annual conference. This last year's conference, sorry, the slide's very fuzzy. We partnered with Bear River First Nation, and the theme of it was Two-Eyed Seeing, which is the balance between Indigenous perspectives and modern science perspectives. So we try and partner, involve First Nations as much as possible as well. And then our March break day is another big event. And I should say that the last two slides, those are something that kind of falls through the cracks in terms of funding. We don't actually have funding for these programs. We just see it as necessary to kind of join the dots for the public. Every spring we have a March break day. This is an example of one of them. We had one on Big Sea Swimmers. Somebody from, I can't remember which university, was brought a dead shark down, and it was available for the kids to see and look at. So, you know, we try and have lots of guest speakers and also lots of activities for kids at those days. It's an afternoon event in the March break. It goes down as a treat. And the very last initiative I'm going to mention, and I'm actually running to a meeting from here in Bridgewater, is the Guestbowick Conservation Collaborative. Again, this is a fairly new initiative. And the idea is there are so many different organizations in Southwest Nova Scotia working on conservation initiatives. And quite often we work in silos and we don't talk to each other. The idea behind the collaborative is that we've been meeting for 2 years now. We're talking to each other. We're saying, hey, we could share this funding. We could share, we know something about working with private landowners that we could share with you. And the idea is that when we're applying for funding, we do it collaboratively to get the best bang for the buck for Southwestern Nova Scotia. That was my last slide. Any questions?
Councillor Deputy Mayor Kelly.
Thanks, Jane. Yeah, I always love when MTRI comes here, because I think it's amazing, absolutely amazing what you guys do. Along the lines, too, with the Harris and Lewis Center, I think that there's so many organizations that do research, like on the South Shore, and it's great what you say, that we are a hub for that. We have so much down here to see, and when I see that, I once asked the question on some of the interns that come down, or the researchers that come down, and Harris and Lewis Center as well, and I'm sure it's the same with yours. Like, I mean, they come here, they want to stay here, they love it here. But also, they're really coveted roles. Like, they, you know, when they come here to get these, and everybody wants to come here,
yeah.
which is great.
Yeah.
And I think that's really great to get the word out about what we have here. And I do believe that the attraction strategy, so many years ago that they did here, identified one of the pillars
research.
Was research,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
And you know, I wish maybe that we could have done more as a municipality to do that. But I mean, I think you guys are doing amazing work on your own. My question is, when it comes to endangered species like the bats, do you think there's any correlation between that or maybe any other endangered species that you're working with that is the reason for our increase in tick population?
I don't know if there's a link between bats and ticks.
Okay.
I think my understanding is it's more, so white-tailed deer are relative newcomers to Nova Scotia, and I think they seem to be one of the vectors. But really, I've heard several theories about how they got here, but
right.
once they're here, they're
yeah.
they're good at being here. It's like so many other invasive species that we have, like the glossy buckthorn and the hemlock woolly adelgid, that maybe in their own environment, they whatever is else is there keeps them in check, and I think
yeah.
whatever does that elsewhere isn't
yeah.
here, or the climate just suits them perfectly.
Is there any other theories about why we have all of these invasive species, but they've just been, because of the way people move around the countries or the worlds, that they just end up being here?
Yeah.
It seems more now, or is it just because we look for them now, or we're more aware of them now?
Well, I think they've always been here, but I think there are more people traveling,
right.
so it's going to happen more. Things like the hemlock woolly adelgid, it's largely, I think, they think it's maybe initially got here through nursery stock, bringing hemlocks from other places.
Right.
But also, it's possible now they think that like the larvae, or the nymphs, I should say, are tiny. They're like the size of a poppy seed, and it's perfectly possible that they could be traveling on migratory birds. So
right.
even if we stopped bringing nursery stock in, chances are it would find its way here anyway. And again, that's just been found in southern Ontario, so it's this kind of awful spread. And I think, you know, things like Japanese knotweed and other invasive species have been here for a long time. And things that we don't even think of as being invasive species, like probably mostly bees, earthworms, you know, that they were introduced as well. So I think things have been introduced for a long, long time. It's maybe just they're coming from more alien environments now
yeah.
and able to.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't
Thanks.
Know if that answers your
no,
question.
No, it does. I just was looking for a bit of background and
yeah.
stuff like that. Yeah.
I don't. Sometimes it's the invasive species thing. I think is probably our biggest threat to lots of our wildlife, especially fish.
Just dealing with so much of it lately,
yeah.
like with the crab, the green crab, and all of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just
and chain pickerel and kedgy
yeah.
and the lakes is fairly disastrous for
exactly,
which has an impact on our tourist
exactly
industry
it's
as well.
You're just trying to keep that balance all the time.
Yeah.
Councillor Fancy.
Yeah, Jane. One thing I would ask about the what do you call that hemlock algae or
woolly
algae?
Adelgy,
or
yeah.
I know I was up in Albany last year doing some survey work and you saw the needles were falling off, you know, like it was in the spring and the
mm-hmm.
needles were falling off, so I expect this, but this was all a part of it. And wondered how that's affecting the trees themselves. Do they recover, or does that, I don't see that in Liverpool. I don't see that into this the area.
Around. So it isn't everywhere yet? It's,
yes.
it's they found it, they think it might have been in Nova Scotia for 10 plus years, but it was kind of confined down in Yarmouth area, but they only found it a few years ago, because if you're not looking for it, it's quite hard to see, and it's not until a tree starts dying sometimes that but when you know what you're looking for, it's very easy to see, especially if it's a really heavy infestation. But yeah, it is, there are pockets where it hasn't reached yet, and it is only in, I think it's been found in, there's a site not too far from the turnoff for Greenfield, it's been found there. It's been found in Caledonia, it's been found, there's lots of it in Bear River, Digby, Yarmouth counties, and I think it's also in Shelburne County, but it is kind of spreading to the east, and the research that we're doing is just trying to see if there's any way that we can slow that. I don't think we can stop it, but yes, it does kill the trees, but it can take a long time, the hemlocks take a long time to die anyway, and then when they die, they take a long time to come down, so we're trying not to get to people to panic and you know, cut all the hemlock, because it's not necessarily, we just don't know as well. This is the furthest north it's been, so we don't know how well our climate is going to be able to mitigate the spread, so yeah, lots of unknowns, unfortunately. But yeah, it kills hemlocks, and you know, hemlock, my biggest worry is most of our old growth forest is hemlock, so we might lose all our old growth as well.
Councillor Piss?
Yes, Jane, very impressive presentation. I want to talk about the turtles a little bit. Are there more turtles this year around than usual?
Only because they found a new population that hadn't previously been discovered. So there's still less than 500 turtles,
I see the red milk containers over top of different areas. Is that for the turtles?
Probably. And it might not be blandings. That people might be doing it for snappers or other things as well. So snapping turtles, although everybody had, you know, gives snapping turtles a hard time, they are now a species of special concern as well. They're becoming quite rare.
Just one more quick question. The bats, I think on the news last night they were discussing rabies in the rat area in the bat.
Mm-hmm.
So is that common or not common?
I think it was discovered in New Brunswick, and certainly the people who are working on bats have had their rabies shots. We're not taking any chances with that. Anyone that handles bats has to have rabies shots from a safety perspective. But whether all bats have it or not, I don't know if anyone's doing that.
Are the numbers improving there?
Pardon?
Are the numbers improving with bats?
I would say yes. I would cautiously say as we're certainly whether it was that they were under-recorded, but we're getting lots of bat reports, and some, it's not just one or two, it's, you know, somebody saw 25 the other day.
Thank you.
Which is really
exciting. Councillor
McLeod. Jane, thank you very much, and it's great to have you back again. Under your research and monitoring area that you presented, you have aquatic health.
Mm-hmm.
Really, what does that mean? What's involved?
So that's one that I guess is... we're not doing too much work on right now, but we are doing some. In the past, we did a lot of water quality monitoring in and outside the park. We also did a loon project, which looks at the accumulation of mercury, because the loon is the top of the food chain. And so it was looking at the breeding success of loons, which can be linked to high mercury levels. But also we've done in the past and currently are looking at like fish passability, so culvert installations, because quite often if a culvert or a bridge is badly installed, it means that fish can't pass through it, so that can have bad repercussions on fish populations as well. So those are some of the kinds of things that we've done research on.
Do you do anything on the wetland area? Do you monitor wetlands, inland wetlands, or I know there's natural wetlands for freshwater, but you don't have anything to do with salt water.
No, we haven't really done anything, any salt coastal
mm-hmm.
areas. I mean, I guess there are other organizations doing that already, like Coastal Action
yes.
are kind of the lead on that. And again, we try and collaborate. Although we've partnered with them on an Atlantic whitefish project as well.
So you do have some collaboration.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The whole guest book thing,
yeah.
The meeting that I'm going to, I would imagine will be at least 3 Coastal Action employees there. And we're going to be talking about, you know, how we can access the funding together rather than competing against each other.
One other topic is ecotourism. And I know you have a wonderful facility there, and you do welcome visitors and put on your workshops. Are you working collaboratively with, let's say, the tourism cooperatives and those types of places where ecotourism seems to be a really big thing, and you would certainly fit into that category?
Yeah. It's something that we've talked about in the past and we've toyed with. Like, we worked with the Mersey River Chalets on doing a turtle day, and it's one of those things that because we're so tied to our project
research.
Funding, like when we apply for funding, we have to say what we're going to do, and then they give us funding and they say, you have to do what you said you were going to do. So unless we tie in ecotourism into those, and many of our funders, that's not what they're funding for. They're, you know, funding for
yes.
research or outreach. So I wouldn't say that we've thrown that out at all, because it's something that we've tried a little bit in the past, but I feel like it could bring revenue to us as well if we were charging for it. But the other issue is you have to be a little bit careful about sensitivity of species. So it's not as if we can say, come and see a Blandings turtle, we'll put you in a canoe and take you to see a Blandings turtle, because you know, we don't necessarily want to be advertising the sites where our rare species are. So.
I remember years ago when Goldwater were active, they took us on a tour of their old growth forest.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing to
yeah.
see that.
Yeah.
And those are the kind of things that
yeah.
visitors would like to see.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess we've done that a little bit in partnership with the community forest, and Parks Canada are already doing a lot of that stuff within the park. But yeah, I totally agree. I think that that's an area that we could look at in the future, yeah.
Thanks.
No, thanks. Thanks for reminding me of that.
Councillor Burwood?
Thank you, Jane, for the presentation. Just a quick question about, there's a lot of controversy right now about infilling our shorelines around lakes and bogs and things like that. So are you available, like, or do you work with the Department of Environment if people have questions about what that can cause? And do you know what doing infill along the shoreline can cause, like the ecosystem? Involved in that in any way?
Well, personally, I haven't been involved in the, I guess that would most be most closely linked to our Atlantic Coastal Plain Flora project, which
okay.
we've had in the past, and we're actually going to get some funding for that this year, although I'm not sure about the details. And that is, those are the rare plants that are found along lake shores. And most of what we've been involved with in the past is trying to discourage people who have properties on lake shores from creating beaches or cutting all the vegetation right down to the lake's edge, because that can have an impact on the hydrology of the lake shore, and putting new substrate down could impact the species that are along there, and there are several species at risk that are found on the lake shores. But technically, I think they're not allowed to do that anyway, or at least you have to have a special permit if you want to do something like that. But that would be the Department of Environment when it comes to permitting and advice. We can give advice, and we have one of our guides is called Healthy Lakes and Wetlands, and that has sort of stewardship actions in there and advice for people who work around wetlands and lakes. But again, it's more guidance. The regulatory stuff comes from the Department of Environment.
And you're not partners with them, or
well, we partner with them
around?
On all kinds of things, but
right.
they do that work, we do ours, but we kind of talk to each other a lot. For example, we had a workshop not that long ago for woodlot owners with wetlands on their land, and we got DOE staff and DNR, DNR staff to come and give that presentation.
Thank you.
Deputy Mayor Kelly.
Yeah, just when you're talking about that, then you were one of the stakeholders that spoke to Uplands for the municipal planning review. Was MTRI was a stakeholder?
Might have been Amanda, not me.
Oh, okay. They should have. I mean, for our municipal planning strategy review and land use bylaws
okay.
update that we're going through right now, I'm
yeah.
pretty sure that MTRI was identified as one of the stakeholders.
Okay.
So there should have been conversations there. So that would take into account where your advice would go a long way to how we actually develop our
mm-hmm.
planning strategy along coastal areas.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm just wondering if that's something that kind of fell through the cracks in the transition of Amanda leaving and Jeffy and I taking over.
Well, maybe we should make sure you
yeah.
connect with Mike McLeod
yes.
to make sure that that your information, I mean, it's up for review right now, so
okay.
it's plenty of time to actually
I'll make
put
a mental note
put
to
your input
to
in there, yeah.
I do remember seeing it, but I know Amanda was still there at the
right.
time, and I was probably
sure.
busy
okay.
doing forestry
sure.
stuff, but
I'll
yeah, for
follow,
sure.
I'll
yeah.
follow up as well, thanks.
Yeah.
Any other councillor have a comment or a question? Well, thank you very much, Jane, for the very interesting presentation today. It's been very formal and providing a large amount of information.
Great, thank you very much.
Great, thanks.
Under 4.0, tabling up petitions today, we have one petition that has been received by the Region of Queens. Read that off to the record. We, the residents of Old Falls Road, Liverpool, Nova Scotia, request this road to become a cul-de-sac. We are experiencing higher than usual levels of traffic over the last few years. This may be a result of one,
the sign location that indicates to turn right for the number 103 highway, Milton or Kedgy. 2, avoidance of the traffic lights, or 3, use as a flow through. We have had numerous close calls due to excessive speed on this road where pedestrians have had to jump out of the way to avoid being struck by vehicles, and also when we are attempting to come out of our driveways to turn on the road, vehicles are speeding by. We are hoping to alleviate this by changing the classification of this road to a cul-de-sac. Please see below for the list of resident signatures that acknowledge our acceptance to change Old Falls Road into a cul-de-sac. We would appreciate your consideration on this and are always available by telephone or public meeting to discuss this option. And it is signed by residents Karen Cowley, Rosie Smith, Betty Kennedy, Allison Williams, Elizabeth Hayes, Sandra Roy, Mike Roy, Dan Williams, Sally DeRuiter, Walton Zari, Irene Zari, Roger Hayes, Sharon Moulton, Karen McGee, Charles McGee, and Angela Dixon. And the process for petitions is that the Region of Queens will review through its staff and have up to 45 days to respond. Are there any other petitions to be filed today? Second call for petitions. Third and final call for petitions. We have no additional petitions today. Moving on to 5.0, public question and comment session. This is the opportunity for residents in the public gallery to speak up to 5 minutes. I would mention that we do audio record our council meetings, so choose your words wisely in your comments. Please state your name and your address, and as I mentioned, you have up to 5 minutes to comment. Leon.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Leon Robinson, coming to you in Liverpool. Couple of things, Mr. Mayor. First of all, I received your updates with respect to the smell and that's been lingering in Liverpool for a couple of months now. And the latest update I received yesterday shows that the contractor is now on site and doing the sledging of the pond or whatever they name on there. And hopefully they'll be done within 2 weeks, and hopefully the smell will be gone.
That would be the goal.
Let's hope so, because it's pretty potent, and particularly in the Bristol area and that area, and it even reaches up to Color Street once in a while, depending on the wind. The second item is with respect to the public meeting that we had down with respect to the waterfront area, and it's called under 8.1, a proposed new waterfront reimagined design, and you have a number of things there. Looking at possibility with respect to library possible and so on. I noticed, and it's been brought up here several times before, both a bandstand in the area down in the park area, and I didn't notice that in there. Maybe I missed it. I didn't get it. Wasn't able to get to the meeting. Anyway, the thing that I look at here is a couple of months ago we had a presentation from a consultant firm saying that the areas within a few years is going to be flooded, and particularly the parking area and so on. So I'm wondering, by putting all this on there, is that you won't have to do the other work first, is that correct?
The waterfront flooding mitigation study has not been fully received yet.
No.
That will move in tandem with the waterfront development study. And of course, there is a cost to development on the waterfront which will require time and hopefully provincial federal funding sharing once it's determined exactly what that would look like. So the consultant that we have that is dealing with the waterfront development has not completed that process, but has held public meetings, and it is a work in progress until we receive the final document.
I think we have to make sure of the mitigation of the waterfront with respect to flooding and so on first. The VIC center is there, and that's built up about 5 or 6 feet higher than anything else in the area, in anticipation of flooding and so on. So
your point is well taken.
Thank you. One last thing. Mayor, under 14.3, with respect to the post office corner, as we call it there, and one of the recommendations there is putting no left turn sign. There's been a sign there, it may not be there now, but there's no left turn sign there for a long time. Very few people adhere to it, and they can down it. If you're saying anything to anybody, oh, that left turn, that means you can't go down Curtin Street. But I know you're saying here, you're going to put a little more on the sign here, I believe, with respect to the left turn into the post office.
It will be a second song. That should be very clear to allow the RCMP to enforce the issue.
They would have to be there full time, I think. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Any other member of the gallery?
David Hoskins, 160 Church Street. As he mentioned, that term there at the post office, I was there at the post office this morning, and one of the town trucks come up and turned in there. So please advise the drivers also.
Thank you. Any other member of the gallery?
Yeah.
Yes, if you would, in the front row.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, councilors. My name is Linda Taylor, and I'm here with my husband Richard today. We live at 471 Main Street, Milton. We are here to address the outside of premises at 465 Main Street, Milton. We have lived beside this property since 1984. Over the years, we have watched this property steadily decline to the state it's currently in. We have written two letters to Mr. McLeod with concerns for our neighborhood. Mr. McLeod did reply in writing as requested, which is very much appreciated. I'd like to thank you for that. We do understand there are procedures to follow in cases like this one, with rules, regulations, and bylaws. This has been an ongoing event for far too many years. You would think that by now this would have been resolved, the property would have been cleaned up, all the derelict vehicles, old buildings, the various shelters for the animals, and more things that can be mentioned would be gone. This includes the cattle and the compliance to the household livestock operation bylaw. The cattle should never return to this property. Is that not correct, Mr. Mayor?
To my understanding, under the Municipal Planning Strategy and Land Use bylaw, cattle are not permitted uses within the zone.
So they will not be returned?
I can't say that. That's out of my control. I can only tell you what our legal municipal planning strategy and land use bylaw allows within Kingston. So that would be a future issue. To my understanding, there are no cattle on that site at this present time. Would that be true?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any other member of the gallery would like to speak today?
Hi, my name is Tracy Brophy, and I am a landowner at 3 Rock Island Lane, LaBelle Road. I'm sure all of you are aware of the ongoing harassment we are receiving from residents and other seasonal cottage owners. As of this past Friday evening, Mr. Morrison was arrested and charged with harassment under the Criminal Code of Canada. He was released on the conditions that he stay a minimum of 100 feet away from me, stay away from Rock Island Lane and my property, and any people I have on my property. Mr. Morrison and his wife, Marion Freeman, are cottage owners in LaBelle. We have supported Greenfield, surrounding communities, and many local businesses in Queens for the past 21 years. We are now landowners in LaBelle. From day one of our land purchase, we have been subject to attempted bullying, intimidation, negative comments, and harassment. We did not receive any warm welcome from most of our local cottage neighbors, as the region of Queens promotes in their literature. Mr. Morrison and his wife, Marion Freeman, started a campaign over several months ago and enlisted others as well. These other people are cottage owners, trailer owners, and residents. None of them attempted to ask us the truth. They were only regurgitating what Mr. Morrison and Ms. Freeman and a few others started speaking of. They in fact told non-truths about us. They know we are not land developers. We are not a business. We are not a campground owner running a business for money. We do not manage a campground. We respectfully request council stop referring to us as a campground. We are in fact landowners who wanted to surround ourselves with family and a few friends. In fact, what it has come down to is constant harassment, bullying, intimidation, lies being spread, vehicle drive-bys, going onto other people's private property to take pictures and video, glaring at us, they pull into our driveway to glare at us or get pictures and videos. They are walking through our property and on Thursday and Friday started driving their four-wheelers and cars onto the adjacent property to glare at us and intimidate us. Mr. Morrison went on another private property 10 feet from us to take pictures. And while the RCMP were present, members of the group drove onto the adjacent property, and RCMP saw this and made note of it. The Morrisons visit the adjacent properties, waving papers around and staring at us, and take pictures, all the while looking to see if we are watching. They have other residents and cottage and trailer owners speaking for them now at these meetings to try and create the appearance of a large group of locals. The Morrisons and several others have engaged in criminal harassment, stalking, libel, and slanderous activity, and it needs to stop. Instead of letting the true and factual bylaw issues play out in an adult manner with the Region of Queens and these council meetings, they have reduced themselves to criminal activity. We have small children on our property and will no longer accept their activity around our property and in front of our property on LaBelle Road. They are in fact causing a loss of enjoyment of our property, and by engaging the other cottage owners and trailer owners and residents, they are creating a loss of enjoyment for them as well. We respectfully ask Council and the Region of Queens staff to insist that the Morrisons and the rest of the group cease and desist from further criminal activity and to stop allowing them to bring forward issues and comments that are embellished and not true. Not one of these people attempted to get to know us or ask any questions. We are also aware of the petition being circulated against us. However, no one has provided us any details. They do not want to know the truth. We all know that the Region of Queens and Council are going to follow the bylaws. The negative and potentially criminal actions have to stop, and if Council continues to engage them, they will continue their harassment of us. We are residents and taxpayers as well. I reached out to all of you by email and also reached out to our local councillor by leaving phone messages for him as well. We have a right to enjoy our property and live in the community just like they do. Yet we are the only ones being investigated. I would like to address comments and issues stated at the last council meeting. Craig Sawyer and Cindy Stafford are owners of the same property. They stated we are developers developing a campground. We are not developers in the business sense, nor are we a campground or campground owners or managers. They referred to use of generators, noise, and traffic increase, etc. They are surrounded by small cottages, and many of them also have trailers on their lots. There are plenty of other people, children, radios, music playing, four-wheelers, motorbikes, commercial dump trucks, heavy equipment, motorhomes, cottage owners, boats, and an increase in cottage traffic this time of year. It is unfair to state we caused this increase, and it is ridiculous to entertain it. There are thousands of people going to their cottages and homes, and they themselves have motorbikes and four-wheelers. They state their concerns about their property assessments and state the potential for tax assessment appeals. Perhaps they and the Morrisons should be more concerned, and it would hold more weight if they pointed out the neglected, derelict, rundown cottage next to their driveway, or the constantly overflowing gray garbage bins that are a dumping ground for everything and anyone and the stench emanating from them. That also attracts bears and wildlife. There is a derelict old trailer on the property directly across from them. There are many outhouses directly across from them, which are less than 100 feet from the lake and throughout this community. There is a large cutout alcohol advertisement on a lot, which stands the height of a man, across from them, which potentially promotes underage drinking and is unsightly. There are many other trailers on lots with many other buildings, all of which do not promote the best visual when you are driving by, which could be referred to as unsightly. There is also the stench from unmanaged outhouses. There are also Airbnb properties as well. All of this caused many issues before we came along, and I wonder if bylaws have been followed or permits applied for before they started building. A person needs to consider this when they build a home in cottage country and do not check the bylaws to see what is able to be built or installed around them. The same goes for any of those complaining. They all had the opportunity to purchase the plot of land we bought, as it had the for sale sign at the beginning of the driveway for a long time. We too have concerns about outhouses being unregulated, the stench coming from them, buildings being built that appear as outbuildings, but are in fact bunkies and shanties that people sleep in. Shale being used close to the water, derelict cottages and trailers, unsightly and untidy properties and lots that are very narrow in width and barely have 50 to 100 feet from the paved LaBelle Road to the edge of their property bordering on the lake. Yet they have buildings less than 50 feet from the water's edge with modified shorelines and removed vegetation. One only needs to look around to see the bylaws and guidelines have not been followed prior to us arriving. We are not the only landowner that would be affected by all the comments and bylaws being enforced because of the complaint-driven system. You are potentially looking at hundreds of landowners without proper permits and bylaw infractions. We have not infilled the lake. We have not removed or altered any of the wet vegetation as others nearby have. We have had Danny Shannon, a Department of Environment specialist, confirm there are no rare species, vegetative species, in that area in front of our property. Yet, interestingly enough, no one else is experiencing criminal harassment. And again, the complainers have not asked us a single question to find out the truth or get to know us. They are all relying on the untruthful hearsay of one or two people. Another owner stated issues regarding our property causing an increase in people, residents, noise, boats, and traffic. I would like to state at the time, we did not even have a boat in or near our property. Yet, the owner who complained has four motorized boats and other watercraft. In fact, there is also a travel trailer, outhouse, and other buildings on that property, as well as several vehicles. These comments are pointless. Why buy a property in an area where there are already thousands of cottages, trailers, boats, and traffic if you wanted silence? If this group of people were concerned about noise bylaws, traffic, boats, trailers, generators, etc., then they need to look around their community and take notice of their friends and neighbors and cottage owners with outhouses too near the lake and with trailers on their lots that will also be affected by what their accusations are against us. We have a groomed lot with lots of trees being replanted along the driveway and in our garden. Our trailers are not old and run down. We respectfully request you look into the outhouses in the area, check the complainants for permits and occupancy permits for cottages, homes, and outbuildings, assess the type of rock people have on their property and whether it needs to be removed, whether or not shorelines have been altered, and that other proper requirements are met, as well as unkept and untidy and unsightly properties. The bylaw regarding outhouses needs to change to require permits, or better yet, just plain ban them altogether. They are a hazard to the environment, especially so close to the lake. They are unsightly and create a stench you can't get away from. They create the potential for appeals of property assessments. This area is cottage country. It is cottage and boating season. There are hundreds of cottage owners on Pondhook and many other lakes in Queens that have multiple trailers and multiple buildings on their lots. One only needs to take a drive around or go by boat to see the changes to lots that take place every season on these lakes. You can clearly see completely cleared lots to water's edge, most trees removed, new buildings going up, many people making noise, people going off-grid that use generators and also have boats. Yet we are being singled out by a group of people who need to take a look around in their own community. Mr. Morrison stated to the police that he did not want trailers on our lot, and he has made it his mission to try and destroy us one way or another. This continued harassment by the rest of this group needs to stop. The region of Queens is all about welcoming new residents and is trying to encourage people to move here now or retire here. The type of behavior being shown by this group absolutely destroys any of these statements. Mr. Morrison's recent arrest and criminal charges prove his behavior is unwelcoming and unbecoming of an adult, let alone a teacher. He has others in the community harassing us along with himself. We have been subject to libel, slander, harassment, bullying, intimidation, and loss of enjoyment of our property. This ongoing behavior and the comments and statements before you affect the amount of money flowing into Queens and its communities. Other residents, seasonal campers, and cottage owners will be and are being affected by this behavior when making their decisions to stay here, retire here, and spend money in Queens. Many people are aware of what is taking place with our lot and the surrounding people. Mr. Morrison's niece is even telling customers at White Point Beach Lodge that we are hated by her family and they want us gone. They don't even know us. This is the type of unwelcoming environment that is being spread by this group. Their behavior and statements is being shared many times over around Queens and Bridgewater, as well as Mr. Morrison's recent arrest for criminal harassment. Please take our concerns and comments into consideration, and again urge this group of people to stop the constant harassment and not entertain the unfounded comments and statements being made to council members and the Region of Queens staff. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for your comments today, Ms. Brophy. As you're aware, our development officer, Wendy Connors, is the one that is in charge of this file. We await through council her work to be completed before this would ever get to council in this regard. So thank you for your comments, and certainly Ms. Connors is in the room to hear your comments as well. Any other member of the gallery would like to speak today? Well, thank you all for your comments, and thank you for attending today. We will move on now to 6.0.